Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I'm Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamant.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you today, Robert?
Today, Russell, I am feeling like a superhero.
Really? That's a nice feeling. And why?
Well, I'm feeling like a gay superhero, which is how today's guest has been described by another friend and creative mind, very talented Jonathan Anderson, actually titled our guest today as a gay superhero. And it got me thinking about that description, because actually it's a perfect way to sum him up. He's a multi-hyphenate kind of guy. Like, he is an actor, he's a comic actor at times, but also now a serious actor, emotional actor, but also a screenwriter, a writer. He has his own line of sunglasses, which I adore. He's even done collaborations with like SS Daily. He's a style icon. He's becoming a style icon, I mean, in my opinion. And also, he's slightly like a doppelganger for me, because every time I see something I like, the next day I see a photo on the internet of him wearing it. He always gets there first. And we seem to have very similar taste in clothes. And the way that he expresses himself, and also politics and kind of bringing people together through what he wears, the kind of messaging on the red carpet at things like the Met Gala, but also just, you know, red carpets for his recent show, Good Grief, which is now on Netflix, which is the most incredible emotional movie. And it was surprising to me on so many levels, because I'd obviously seen Schitt's Creek previously, and I know that he started out as a TV presenter. I mean, that's another skill he did back in the day, like right at the beginning on MTV in Canada. So he's really talented. And I also think he's really careful with his choices. Like, he's very particular about the actors he works with. Like, in Good Grief, there's our friend Emma Corrin is in it, and just amazing actors. We can talk about that in a minute. And I just love his quality, his kind of quality control, and his very visionary way of writing current modern day stories, but in a really fresh way. So we would like to welcome to Talk Art,
Dan Levy.
Hi, Dan.
Hi, boys. How are we?
Hi. Good. Where are
so
you in the
world? So happy to be here. I've heard that opening so many times that it's surreal at this point to actually be communicating with you.
That's a real privilege to us that you've been listening to Talk Art and know that opening so well. So welcome.
For a long time, yeah. I used to put you on in the gym while I was making Schitt's Creek, and it would, for some reason, it was like, instead of music, I would put on this podcast.
No
way. Oh my God.
Way.
I remember that, because I first met you at GQ Heroes. I remember back then you saying you were listening to Talk Art, and I called Russ and was like, what? Like, Dan Levy listens to Talk Art?
Yeah, but the fact that you were listening to it while you were writing Schitt's Creek is just like amazing. Thanks.
Yeah, it was, I had a really bad experience with like an intro to the art world. I sat beside an art consultant at a dinner once, who was so pretentious and condescending that for years I didn't even like think about touching like art. I didn't think about investing in it. I didn't think about trying to find my way through it. It was one of those things where I just thought, okay, this is, and I know that it was kind of a one-off, because then I started listening to the podcast thinking, well, I have interest in art and the art world, but I never felt welcome by way of this person. I think through this podcast, it like opened my eyes and opened my mind to the possibility of not doing it wrong, kind of, if that makes sense.
Where was this dinner and what exactly did they say to you then? And why were you, how old were you at this point?
It was like within the past 10 years and it was at a friend's house and it was just a very kind of, you know, it was like, well, what are, they were talking about like artists that I paid attention to. And, you know, when you don't know art, you only know kind of the sort of bigger names that everyone tends to know. And there was a real, I felt a real kind of judgment and like, well, of course you'd think that, or of course that's who you're going to. But the reality is, I wouldn't expect someone who doesn't know anything about film to like know the nuance of independent cinema.
Oh my God, no.
Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, it reminds me of this story. Like, me and my friends were sat, a couple of friends were not in the art world and they do feel intimidated by it. And we were sat after some event and there was a woman there and she was sort of going, so who's everyone's favourite artist? And they were completely panicking, or favourite artwork. They were completely panicking. They just went to the other one, just say the Mona Lisa. Just say the Mona Lisa, because that's the only thing they could think of. When it went round, we were all being really kind of nuanced with what we liked and why. And they were like, Mona Lisa. And then she just sort of looked at them like, uh-huh, okay. And it was, but I understand that pressure just to be like, oh my God, I've got to say something.
But also that's so specific to location as well, because it depends what country or city you're living in, you know, the big blockbuster shows that have come through, you know, in your childhood, all of these things, like, and not everyone has access to art, or, and you know, it's horrible. I hate that judgy kind of thing. It just shuts down any interest, which is essentially what sounds like
it happened to you. Yeah.
And yet I think there are people that exist, there are people that need to be defined by what they do in every industry. And those are the people that I think turn a lot of people off of, from the industry, you know, the people that kind of aren't sure of themselves enough to be welcoming. So their power lies in knowing something that other people don't. And that, I think, is like a quality in a person that is like up there with arrogance for me in terms of like just being a total turnoff.
Did you grow up with art at all? Or because you're Canadian and you grew up in Toronto, you didn't have any art in the house?
No. We had art in the house, but my parents, I don't know if they... I think they weren't sort of collectors. They bought, you know, art that they liked in now I'm sort of throwing my parents under the bus. But I think they bought it like at antique shops or like place, you know, I don't think they were buying, they weren't investing in art. They didn't, you know, I would go to the like Art Gallery of Ontario growing up and see the exhibits, and I knew about the Group of Seven. And
what's the Group of Seven?
Oh, the Group of Seven are a collection of Canadian painters. I believe it was exclusively painting, but I could be wrong. It might be sculpture. Lauren Harris being one of them. But it was a collective of painters in Canada who sort of had their own aesthetic, I want to say. I'm the last person that should be speaking to this, but it's a very famous collective of painters in Canada that really kind of created their own world of painting that reflected the Canadian identity. And they're incredibly valuable now. I mean, they're...
Yeah, but also it was a landscape focus, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was like landscape.
They shared this vision for it. It's kind of a super famous movement, but it's not even that far back in history. It's like 1920s or something. Like it's, you know, it's recent history. Because I remember when I was in Canada, everyone used to talk about that.
Yeah, there's a lot. I mean, it's like a very famous sort of... the artists are very famous in Canada. And I think kind of Steve Martin collects a lot of the Group of Seven.
He's a great collector. I went to Steve Martin's apartment once. I mean, this is just a name drop. And a friend had been working, he had the show on Broadway called Meteor Showers, and a friend producer knew him. And after the show, he went, do you want to go to Steve's apartment? And I was like, Steve who? And he said, Steve Martin. I was like, yeah. So we turned up and the elevator door opened. He's like, hello. I was like, hi. So come through. So we sort of went, oh my God, go to Steve's apartment. And then in the hallway was like these, I mean, I don't know if I'm allowed to say this, but I'm going to say it anyway. There was like two Giorgio Morandi paintings. And these paintings are worth $2.5 million upwards each. And his wife was there. And I said to his wife, oh my God, these paintings by Giorgio Morandi, these two paintings are amazing. She went, no, no, there's a third. If you just go around the corner. And I was just like, what the fuck? And then he walked around the corner. There was like a Freud and a Bacon. And I was just like, what? And he's got the most incredible collection. And that's what he sort of invested all of his time and attention into outside of writing and acting and playing the banjo.
It's kind of wild to see them in people's homes. I had a friend whose grandparents were big, are big art collectors in Canada. And I remember like not really getting a heads up to exactly what I was walking into. But there were like soup cans in the bathroom. Like there were three soup cans just by the toilet in the guest bathroom of this.
What, like screen prints, Warhol screen prints or actual soup?
Yeah, that they had commissioned, I guess, from him.
Whoa.
And then there were like eight more by the stairs. And then there were huge like Lichtensteins and Rauschenbergs and huge Jasper Johns, like several large Jasper. I think they're, anyway, I remember just thinking, I have an IKEA poster pinned to my wall right now. Like, this is next level.
Well, what about now, though? So you do collect. There's an artist that you sort of worked closely with when on Good Grief that you've been collecting for over a decade now.
Yeah, Chris Knight.
Rocky's just shouting 2 seconds. Rocky, let it go, mate. Life's good. Stop. Carry on.
So when the movie got greenlit, there's a large sort of element of the film. I mean, my character is a painter in the movie, and I knew that we had to get the paintings right in order to ground the film and not have it completely unravel at the end, because like bad paintings at the end of this movie would ruin it.
If we've been building up to see what your work's like, and then so at the true. End it's like terrible, yeah.
And also that's a thing, that there's loads of art films that have failed at the last hurdle, and it's because of the art, and the film's all about art, and then they just have a set designer basically make the art, and it looks awful.
Okay, so he was the first phone call I made. And I sort of laid the film out for him and told him that it ends on this gallery show, and it would be really important, and I think it would actually be a really nice showcase for his work if he was interested. And he said, "It's funny you ask, because a week prior, I was having a conversation about Francesco Clemente's work in Great Expectations, and had always kind of had this desire to do that, and then here you are." And we had to work out a contract, but he said yes, and was the first person signed on to the movie. And I knew,
that's so clever.
I knew once we had him that the end of the film would work, which was a huge relief.
So this is a movie that you wrote and directed and starred in. Why did your character of Mark need to be an artist? What was it about the artist's life that appealed to you when writing the character?
I think in a way it was like I didn't want to make him a writer because that felt too on the nose. But I had a personal relationship to creating things and understood sort of how and why I make things. But I needed that level of separation between, you know, the character I was writing and myself. And so in my head, I had always been thinking about Chris. I find his paintings to be, oftentimes it's like, you know, it's portraits. He's just, I don't know. I've been very captivated by his work. I've been very moved by his work, and just thought that a visual medium was something that needed to happen. I wanted a kind of visual expression as opposed to, in my case, like writing something down. So it was always painting. You know, I thought about like sculpture, but then you get into really even hairier territory in terms of like, I don't know if I need to be with like clay, you know,
like
I'm
ghost.
Like, I have a lot of responsibilities as is in this movie. Like, I don't need to, you don't need to see me, you know, at a pottery wheel.
Oh my God.
We do.
And also,
we
you're
do.
Already doing a hell of a lot of stuff because you're like producing it, directing it, writing it, acting in it, you know, working with your fellow actors. But also, can you imagine having bad sculpture in the film? It would have like ruined the film again.
Yeah. Listen, you got it. Sometimes it's just you go the safest path. Although he was there like guiding me through. There's a scene where I have to start sketching.
Yes.
And so he came.
With a projector, isn't it?
Yes, toward the end of the movie.
Yeah.
And he was there and sort of walked me through. He set up the whole studio for us and walked me through how he would start his paintings, and so that everything that I was doing was actually what he would have done. So it was important for me to really respect the art form. You know, I didn't ever want to take the fact that the character was a painter for granted. I really wanted to honor the reality of it. And it was, he played such a wonderful part, you know, part of authenticating all of that.
How did you come across him? Because he's Toronto-based, so he's a Canadian artist, is where you're from, Canada.
Yeah, I think I'd heard of him, like, in just being in Toronto. We had, like, I think some mutual friends, and I want to say I went to one of his early shows, even, and I just love the aesthetic. I love the way that he plays with color. And then he did a collaboration with Gucci, several years ago that was really great. And then I just started to look into, once I had a job that paid me enough to actually like invest, then I started to follow him a little more closely and figure out, okay, well, you know, at the time I didn't even know how much his work cost. So that was a hurdle, you know, first and foremost. I think there's also this incredibly intimidating element of not knowing the value of the art world, too. And when you walk in, like, asking someone, well, how much is this? You know, the truth is sometimes it can be affordable, and sometimes you're left with a number that's so huge that you have to kind of, like, interesting. I'm going to think about that one.
I'm gonna think about it.
To you. So, you know, I had saved up some money, and there were these two paintings that I had sort of been tracking. He does these; they were kind of the back of men's heads, and I tracked down the price, and I got a nice paycheck for my show, and I bought both of them. And then bought a third, which was this kind of illustration of a book, The Portrait of Dorian Gray, which I loved, with kind of flowers all around it. And that was my first sort of investment, which felt great. And then they show up at your house, and that's a whole other thrill.
Can I ask how do you build a contract for an artist that's making paintings for a movie? And do you then own the paintings because they're all of the characters?
Yeah.
Were they wrap gifts for everyone? You do own everything. What does the artist... Because I read that he had made between...
Ultimately.
So he made 15 to 17 paintings for the movie. So that was like a budget was carved out for a commission at his like primary pricing.
Yeah. And I mean, Netflix technically owned the paintings, but they gave them to me. Which was very nice. And yeah, I'm trying to figure out what to do. I mean, I was really pushing to do a show that would promote the film.
Nice.
Where people could actually come and like tour the same kind of gallery space that you find at the end of the movie. And I think it was probably too ambitious for everyone over there in the, I don't know, they had other plans for the movie. But
so you have about 20 Chris Knight paintings now in your collection.
Yeah, we went from 3 to, to a few more. But the strange thing is, I think 4 of them are portraits of myself. So, you know, it's
and they're all above your bed.
Talking about the portrait of Dorian Gray.
Exactly. I'm giving some to my... I think I'm giving, like, the big one at the end of the movie to my parents. And and a friend had asked for one of the smaller ones. But, it was... I'm trying to figure out what to do with them. And at the end of the premiere of the movie, we had them all on display. So as everyone left the film, they were all there to see. So at least we got an element of that kind of interaction, because they're really kind of stunning up close.
I'm sure Luke would like his one.
I think Luke, I think will get his. There's a few of Luke's. There's a couple Luke paintings, always in repose. There's
always
some good ones, yeah. It's I have to figure out how to.
And this is Luke Evans, for everyone who hasn't seen the film yet.
Luke Evans,
Welsh actor, and he's also been a talk art guest before, so you can find out about his journey in the archive. You know, Dan, one of the things I've always loved about you is the way you champion people's creativity, and just hearing that story then of you following that artist, like you've got this kind of irrepressible curiosity, and it's like you want to learn everything you can. And I've seen it in the way that you look at fashion as well, but also in the attention to detail about how you present yourself on the red carpet. And even right now, you're wearing a Joe Brainard drawing on your t-shirt, I think. It's like of men's underwear from the 80s, and he's not
completely by accident, in the AIDS mind you. Crisis. I would like now to say that it was a festive choice.
Like a deliberate talk art t-shirt.
Yeah, exactly.
Choice. Yeah, but and you've all, I just love the way you've almost become like this kind of, you sort of sing people's, you know, praises in terms of the way that you act in the world and the way that you present yourself. Like, you're kind of always championing people, whether it be like Stefan Daly, who's a young you know, emerging fashion designer, Stefan Cook, a young emerging fashion designer, SS Daly, or like Jonathan Anderson, JW Anderson, like Loewe. Can you talk a bit about your interest in sort of art in clothes?
I think I've always had it. I grew up without any access to like fashion. My parents aren't interested in it. I would get like one sweater and one pair of pants every school year to kind of like add to this pathetic collection of like basic sweaters and jeans that I had. And I always had this fascination. I think I always had a curiosity and a preoccupation with like expressing myself through clothes, but never had access to it. And then when you have the means to buy it for yourself, it kind of exploded. And my whole life now is almost a reaction to not having the ability to do that. So, you know, a lot of my closest friends work in fashion. I've spent a lot of my, like, you know, from my 20s in and around people who are in the design process and have been able to, you know, understand, I guess, a little more about just how meaningful the process is, which I think is the great thing about any sort of, you know, creative field. It's like the more you know, the more you care. And I've just loved it. And I think the interesting thing about Jonathan is that I remember tracking down a pair of his shoes from his first J.W. Anderson collection, which was, I believe, in 2010, mm-hmm. something around wow. there.
It sounds about right.
They were these studded combat boots that he made way early on. And then when we got to know each other, I had brought it up to him, and he said, well, I think I've known your name, because at that time, only like 10 of those boots sold. So I knew everyone's name. I don't know. I love it. I love the way that, you know, getting dressed makes me feel. I love the idea of self-expression through clothing.
But you know what else it is for me? It's like in Schitt's Creek. I know that's a bit of an obvious one, but your character in Schitt's Creek had a big preoccupation with fashion and a big obsession with clothes, as did a lot of the other characters. And I remember talking to you about that, and you said something like you were constantly on eBay or constantly on Vestiaire or all these kind of resale websites trying to find the exact dress that might one of the characters, like your mum, might have worn in it, or that you might have worn, or and then that became this whole kind of ongoing interest. And then I noticed
an addiction that I now can't shake, except now it's my
an
money and not a television show's money that's buying the costumes. But yeah, I mean, you know, I think Schitt's Creek was the first opportunity that I had to really access fashion that I had loved for many years. But, you know, like, I'm not buying, you know, Gesquiere women's Balenciaga. There's no need for me to have that. I'm not a collector like that. But it was nice when, you know, we had a character like Catherine's who was very fashion forward. And it was also really important for me to authenticate her character in real clothing. I didn't want to put like a Zara necklace around her neck that was fake diamonds and call it a day. I wanted people who understood fashion to take something away from the show as well. I wanted that level of, you know, depth and connection to happen, and it worked because people started paying attention, and that was cool.
It became a whole thing, didn't it? Yeah, and even the book you made, when I first met you in 2021, you released a book, and I think the book has incredible detailed images of all the clothes and the
but it's all like Rick Owens and Dries Van Noten and Helmut Lang. It's really like
there
bougie.
Was a Helmut Lang like mohawked hooded cashmere sweater that I had wanted ever since I think I saw Elijah Wood wearing it in like an editorial spread sometime in the early 2000s and had always wanted it and ended up tracking it down on eBay for the show. And I ended up wearing it in the field at the Amish farm. Yes. And the visual of it to me was the thing. I knew how I wanted the shot to look. And I thought, okay, sunglasses, you know, horsehair, mohawk, cashmere sweater in a field on an Amish farm is what this show is about. Like, and we did it.
But also, like, good grief, it got me thinking, because we'd had that conversation about Schitt's Creek. When I was watching it, like, the clothing in that says so much about all the characters, and particularly yours, because, like, some of the jumpers, like, when you're first in Paris and you're in the apartment and you're wearing this like, soft knit, there was all these kind of references, and it really got me thinking about the psychology of an artist or a painter and, like, how your character was then, you know, presenting themselves to the world or feeling, and about textures and all those kind of meticulous details that I think you're so fucking good at.
Thanks. Yeah, I mean, costume design has always been, like, to me, such an important way of revealing character without having to write bad, schlocky, expositional dialogue for the actors. There's so much you can say through the clothes. And so I've always had, like, a very close relationship with my costume designers because I don't want to have to write things that I don't have to write, and I don't want actors to have to say things that they don't want to say, when we can really try to build out their lives in ways all around them without them having to explicitly describe their sadness or, you know, their confusion or the feeling of needing to protect themselves from something. I mean, we shift the way that we, you know, the way that we present ourselves is often a reflection of how we feel. And, you know, when I want to feel a little bit, when I'm in a bad place and I want to feel a little bit better about myself, I'll dress up a little more. And when I'm at my most comfortable around people, I'm more casual. These are the kinds of things that seem obvious, and yet so often, and I'm sure you can attest to this, you go into a wardrobe truck and you're like, Is this it? This is who I am? I had higher hopes for myself. So it's important. Costuming is, I think, such a valuable way of describing a character without them having to describe themselves.
Totally. There was a moment I want to talk about. Rob was talking about collaborating, Jonathan Anson, Loewe, and how you use your place in the world to, you know, show people, artists, you know, people, their opportunity. And what you did was at the Met Gala in 2021, there was an incredible moment where you came out in this puff-sleeved, beautiful, like, jellyfish, but with the work of David Wojnarowicz, who is a massive art hero of mine. He died in 1992 of AIDS at 37 years old. And there's an image, a very famous work by him called Fuck You, Faggot Fucker, and it's two men kissing each other with, like, these atlas maps in the background showing about displacement of, you know, queers across the planet. And it was a really kind of groundbreaking moment for representation and for yourself. And there were so many op-ed pieces. I mean, I was looking before talking to you today, I went to go back on it, and there are literally hundreds and hundreds of articles of people's opinions on that, the reviews, how important it was. Some people are offended. Some people are saying, like, you know, full of praise. But what that represented was so brilliant. What was that like for you?
And radical. Like, it was radical.
How did that come about?
Well, it was, we had just come out of COVID, or we're at the tail end of COVID, and I think our entire lives, In every sense of it, we're kind of thrown up into the air. And it was, you know, it was an incredibly kind of politically charged time. Mm. And the theme at that season was In America. And I think Jonathan and I wanted to say something about America, about the, you know, the voices that have existed in America that were often sidelined for political reasons. And we thought it would be an important contribution to the theme of the Met Gala to represent a voice that needed more attention. And so that kind of started the journey into what that would be, talking about a part of America that was both like, you know, talking about the artistic contribution, but also about the way that artist was treated. And so Jonathan came to me with both of those works and said, I want this to be our sort of foundation.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
And from there, we kind of built out, in his words, kind of like a superhero armor by way of that work, which was, you know, commissioned, and he sought all the approvals, and they made a great donation.
Yeah, I saw that it was in association with the estate, but also PPOW Gallery, who show the work of David, and right. Also Loewe themselves and Jonathan gave a donation to Visual Aids,
yes.
Which is such an amazing charity, which David himself, the artist, had actually supported in his lifetime. And yeah. It's just such a beautiful thing. But I also just think it shows the power of creativity, a bit like your film, actually, right now, Good Grief, to make people feel things and to bring about change.
Yeah, but also,
you know, in the UK right now, we've got the post office scandal, which has been going on, and like the TV series is managing to like, you know, make all these innocent people be innocent and have all their convictions quashed. And I just think it shows you, you know, Russell T. Davis the other day wrote this beautiful text all about how, you know, TV, art, film, all of these things still matter and they need more funding.
But also from that, so many people discovered the work of David Wojnarowicz.
Yeah.
So what you actually did was you achieved so much from that, and that's so incredibly important.
Totally.
But also there was...
Yeah, it introduced a whole new generation
to that work.
But
also
David's work.
There was a clutch you had there that it was... from a work by David Wojnarowicz called One Day This Kid. And it's this amazing text. And in the middle is a picture of David, and he had a really tumultuous childhood and growing up of that unlucky generation and, you know, succumbing to AIDS tragically. But there's a photo of him as this innocent kind of buck-toothed kid in the middle. And there's this amazing text around it. And I don't know if you'd be keen to read that text to us, because I think it's really amazing and it'd be wonderful if you'd consider reading it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was also part of what made being there so special. To your point, it was, I think from our perspective, it was putting someone front and center, sparking conversation, sparking attention. Why not seize that opportunity? You know, what is the downside to that, if not to show people an artist that had a lot to say and continues to have a lot to say. And so they put this work on kind of a clutch, which I thought was a very sort of subliminal thing. You know, it's like if you knew what it was, it's there. If you wanted to zoom in on the picture, it's there. And yet it entered this big institution in a way that felt radical. You know, it snuck itself in a way that felt kind of mischievous and significant.
Yeah, and subversive.
Yeah, cool. Exactly. So I'll try my best to read it.
Yeah, and also people can look up the image on that thing called the internet.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've seen it at the Whitney Museum in New York, this work. It's been on display a few times, I think. It's such an iconic piece.
Yeah, okay. One day this kid will get larger. One day this kid will come to know something that causes a sensation equivalent to the separation of the earth from its axis. One day this kid will reach a point where he senses a division that isn't mathematical. One day this kid will feel something stir in his heart and throat and mouth. One day this kid will find something in his mind and body and soul that makes him hungry. One day this kid will do something that causes men who wear the uniforms of priests and rabbis, men who inhabit certain stone buildings, to call for his death. One day politicians will enact legislation against this kid. One day families will give false information to their children, and each child will pass that information down generationally to their families, and that information will be designed to make existence intolerable for this kid. One day this kid will begin to experience all this activity in his environment, and that activity and information will compel him to commit suicide or submit to danger in hopes of being murdered or submit to silence and invisibility. One day this kid will talk. When he begins to talk, men who develop a fear of this kid will attempt to silence him with strangling, fists, prison, suffocation, rape, intimidation, drugging, ropes, guns, laws, menace, roving gangs, bottles, knives, religion, decapitation, and immolation by fire. Doctors will pronounce this kid curable, as if his brain were a virus. This kid will lose his constitutional rights against the government's invasion of his privacy. This kid will be faced with electroshock, drugs, and conditioning therapies in laboratories tended by psychologists and research scientists. He will be subject to loss of home, civil rights, jobs, and all conceivable freedoms. All this will begin to happen in 1 or 2 years when he discovers he desires to place his naked body on the naked body of another boy.
Thanks for that, my God. Dude, it's just so fucking powerful, and it's so terrifying that he wrote that in the 80s, and here we are, you know, in 2024, and it's like that sort of situation is happening still, you know. Yeah. That view, that opinion, it's just fucking wild. And do you look at a lot of historical queer art and also contemporary queer artists? Because I know that Chris Knight, who you've amplified in the film, it looks through his work with a queer lens. Obviously, David Wojnarowicz was a queer man. Is that really important to you when you're looking at art now?
I think so. I mean, I think for me, it's just I have to have a kind of emotional attachment to it. And I think art is this amazing thing, especially if you want to kind of collect it. And I'm sort of, you know, thanks to you guys, often like feel excited to collect and explore. It has to reflect my life in some way. Like, it has to make me feel something. And yet at the same time, I think you kind of have to, it's a vulnerable thing too, because if you want to do it genuinely, and again, I think collection is something that there's two prongs to it. There's like a business side to it, and then there's a personal sort of desire to be surrounded by things that stir you. And I am more on that side than anything else. But there's a vulnerability in saying, I like this. I don't know if other people like this. Like there's something in me that makes me want to put this in my home and show it off. And that's a kind of extension of your own sense of self. And I don't know. There's this, I think there's a vulnerability that has to exist in the desire to collect art, you know? Does this make any sense?
Yeah, it does. But do you find a vulnerability in a lot of queer art then, because you are seeing yourself reflected and it is our lived experience that we're sort of
recognizing? Yeah, like there was this, Anne Carson is like a Canadian poet, is almost not doing her enough justice, but I wrote her to get to use a quote from one of her poems in the movie. And like, speaking of art, she has a long form poem called Autobiography of Red. And that, I think, is one of the most influential pieces of art that I've ever come across. It's changed, like, it changed my whole life. I read it in one sitting. It's about 90 pages or something. And it is, it completely, I mean, aside from just the beauty of the words, it was the visual, like, storytelling. And it inspired me to tell stories. It inspired me to go look at art. It inspired me to, you know, touch clothes. It inspired me to, it's just, I think it's one of the greatest, like, contributions to, you know, I don't even want to say, like, queer art, because it's everyone should read it, but it does have a queer slant to it. She has sort of reinterpreted the myth of Heracles and Geryon as a kind of queer love story, and it will change your life.
You should read Song of Achilles by Madeline Miller, if you've not read that, because I think you'll love that then.
I will do that.
Yeah, Madeline Miller, amazing.
And there was this, like, Ellsworth Kelly lithograph that I had found myself kind of obsessed with. I'd seen this portrait that he did of his friend, and he used to, I guess, make these sort of pen and pencil little, very sort of crude portraits of friends of his. And this one in particular, his friend David, who's just this, like, it was this beautiful face, really simply sort of done. I don't know what the, I don't know whether it was pencil or pen, but I kind of fell in love with this man's face and saved up the money to buy the, like, lithograph of it, because I just wanted, I wanted it near me. I had this whole, I developed a crush on this like lithograph, on this like portrait. You know, I would kill to have the original, but, you know, I'll settle with what I can afford. But it was amazing. I mean, and I think Chris's paintings do the same thing for me. There's like an attraction to some of the, I love portrait. And I think I collect a lot of like portraits because I don't know. I love people's faces. I love the way that people interpret people's faces. I think painting a person's face is like such an act of like love. You have to kind of find something that you love in someone's face in order to want to draw it, I suppose, or even sort of rage or anything. But there has to be something in the subject that compels you to put their face on a canvas.
So that was an artist called Paul P. from Toronto as well, a Canadian artist, and he's sort of been, he goes in and out of attention, and he's sort of been overlooked. He's represented by Maureen Paley Gallery here, and he's in his mid-40s, based in Toronto, and he reimagines found erotic porn images pre-AIDS, so like from the 1970s, and he goes into Canadian lesbian and gay archives, and he finds these anonymous boys, men, and then paints them. And I'm surprised, because I see a similarity with Chris Knight's work as well. Do you know Paul P?
I don't, but I'm...
Oh, you should look up Paul P.
Yeah,
now,
I have
because
to.
I think you're going to...
Yeah, you'd love it. They're so exquisitely painted as well. They're, in real life, they've got such an aura, and his colour choices are really specific.
He's got a real cult following, but I think
he's
really like...
Like Matthew Higgs, I think, likes him in White Columns in New York.
He's really, really overlooked, like, but
he's
amazing.
He's an artist, really. And actually, Maureen's had a lot of queer artists like that,
yeah,
who are kind of... She's really just championed non-stop. And obviously some of them, like Wolfgang Tillmans, have become really famous, but... She was showing all kinds of different voices.
Yeah,
fun fact.
Not even just figuration, like abstract.
Patrick Carroll. Do you know Patrick Carroll?
No.
I know him, yeah.
He's great, and he had a show in LA last year, I want to say, and I bought two of his pieces. He sort of knits. Jonathan did a collaboration with him as well, but he does these kind of... I can kind of show you the... But he does like...
Oh yeah,
I haven't framed it or put it up yet, but it's like, so it's these like words That one says, brought again to life, made once more to speak.
And is it's stitched into a canvas?
Yeah, like I have a small one. Hold on.
It's like, it's sort of like embroidery.
Sorry, I'm packing to leave, but I have this one that I have to get framed, but it just says...
Doubt. Oh, that's nice.
I love what he does. It's nice to have some success, because now you can actually, like...
Buy art.
Yeah.
I know. Every time I do a job, I'm like, "Oh, I can. I'm going to get a piece of art for this job."
Yeah, exactly.
it's really nice.
You kind of
talking about art again in Good Grief. So,
can I just give a fun fact about Ellsworth Kelly before we move on?
Yeah,
he had a dog called Orange. That's it. That just comes to the top of my head.
Did he?
Carry on, Rob. Yeah, he called his dog Orange.
He had a dog. Well, my favourite paintings by him are Orange. So that's very handy.
There we go.
I had a dog named Red.
Did you?
Did you?
Mm-hmm. Redmond, but I'd call him Red. My movie's dedicated to him, funnily enough.
Oh,
Good Grief.
Yeah. My grandmother and my dog, they both
passed
away over the process of me making the movie.
Oh, God, because Redmond's in your Vogue video, your 73 questions.
He is.
He's on the couch with you.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry, mate. That's
yeah, he was the, you know, the, like, at the end of the, there's a little moment at the end of the movie where I look over and there's a dachshund sitting on the bus.
Yes.
That was my, like, nod to him, because he was a dachshund corgi mix.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Oh. So, in Good Grief, there are many references to art. One is our mutual friend Emma Corrin, which is one of the funniest things ever, because I know that Emma is obsessed with Marina Abramovic and performance art generally, because they are just interested in that kind of thing. But how did that role come to fruition? Obviously you're best friends, but like actually that, because it's like a failed performance artist in a way, isn't it? It's like kind of awkward.
Yeah, it's like a trust fund kid that was given a little too much money, but is trying. You know, it was, I think at the end of the day, I never wanted it to feel mawkish. I wanted it to feel real. And funnily enough, my best friend Trevor designed the sort of tunic that they unravel over the course of the, you know, the performance. So a lot of friends kind of came together to make that happen. But I knew that he was an artist, and I wanted him to be confronted by an artist who was almost embracing it too much. Like, I'm retreating and they're going full force.
Just trying extra hard.
Yeah, just
slightly too much.
Cringe,
and then there's that desperation
cringy,
in their eyes, which is like...
trying to define themselves in some way by it all. And Emma was staying with me in Los Angeles while I was writing this movie. And this scene came up and I kind of ran downstairs and just asked them if they would play the character. And they said yes. So that's... Emma has kind of been involved in this, in the creation of this movie from its like very early days. So it was nice to kind of have them make a little appearance there. But even that whole process was so great to, you know, like commission a friend who was a designer to make all of that. And, you know, that we had to figure out the logistics of how the tunic would unravel and, you know, it was fun.
I know that when I first met you, we were talking about roles and this idea, because you and Russell have both been openly gay, and that's a terrible phrase, openly gay. Someone said we shouldn't use that
Andrew
anymore.
Andrew Scott,
yeah.
Andrew Scott said we shouldn't use it anymore. But you've been, you know, gay.
Out and proud.
Out and proud and in public for a long time. And it's really interesting when you get that whole kind of Hollywood thing of getting roles and all that thing. And I know that you've obviously written these beautiful roles for queer characters within that film, but also for women, because I feel like Ruth's character is one of the best characterizations I've seen on screen in ages. Like, just, and you know what it is? It's because you can really see that Ruth's character is getting in the way of herself, but she's not an awful person, but she kind of acts in quite a terrible way at times that was quite overbearing and quite like mad in a way, but it's just sad as well. And it's kind of like you just want to hold that person and be like, are you okay? But by the end of it, they've realized and you see this kindness of the character. So I just was interested in about the way that you've written roles, because you're obviously starring in it as well, so you've written yourself a role and for Luke, and that have multi-dimensional, you know, sort of so many different facets. rather than being a cliche gay.
It's like your chosen family. You had your family in Schitt's Creek, and then with Good Grief, this is your chosen family we're now seeing.
Nice.
And that was what I wanted to do after the show ended. I wanted to write a story about how important friendship is, I think particularly to like queer people, because oftentimes being who you are comes at the cost of your family. So, I mean, I feel very lucky that that wasn't the case for myself, but it is for so many people. And I think friendships mean that much more to queer people who have turned to friends, to become family. And I hadn't seen it explored in movies. I hadn't seen friendship be at the center of the story. And I've certainly played the, gay best friend, like in movies, and I'm happy to do it when the part is right. But I've so often just had this desire to take all these friend characters that often get pushed to the sides and bring them back into the center and say, okay, but this is compelling storytelling. This is certainly for me, my friendships are the great sort of loves of my life. And they deserve a story, and the complexities and the ups and downs and the mess of those friendships and how much more, interesting and dimensional and complicated our friendships get the older we get and the more, of our lives we've lived, the confrontations that we have to have in order to invest even further in our friendships, all of that I'd never really seen before. And so I was lucky enough to be able to tell the story. But yeah, I mean, you write, I think as an actor, all I want is to read a part that isn't flat. That is like, the more the character doesn't know about themselves, the better.
Yes.
It gives you so much more to play. And yet oftentimes, particularly I think with like gay parts, at least from my experience, it's like you read it and you go, do they have a home? Do they have a family? Do they have wants or needs outside of this cubicle that I'm sitting beside, like paying snarky lines to? Like, who are these people? And I don't think there's a lot of thought and care put into those characters because they're kind of comedic relief, or they're a little bit of spice that gets thrown into to the storyline of a
sass. Yeah.
And I just love writing flaws. I love writing, what I know and what I love in my friends, which is not perfection. It is the complete opposite. That's why I love them. And so it takes more time, obviously, to like sit down and say, okay, what is wrong with this person? Let's start there and then find what's right with them,
It's beautiful. It's beautiful. The performances you get from Himesh Patel and Ruth Negga Luke Evans and yourself. It's everybody listening, you have to go and watch Good Grief on Netflix.
It's also the loyalty within the friendship group, and also how it's your grief because you've lost, the one that you loved. But they're all going through their own shit as well. And while they want to be there for you, and I love the way that then your character has to be there for them too. But then that's the thing about friendship, is that it's this wonderful thing. And I haven't really seen anything like it on TV. It also weirdly reminds me a bit of like Notting Hill, and like there's a kind of romance to the British. Yeah, like that kind of feel to it that I think so specific to like, it's kind of a joyous thing. Like I'm staying in central London at the moment. I was looking out the window and I'm seeing the London that you see, which I don't, you've kind of made me fall in love with the UK through your eyes as an American writer. It's really interesting, and not in a cheesy way, in quite a sweet way. Like, there's a kind of romance, almost like Mary Poppins or something. Not
Dan Levy is good for tourism. So thank you very much.
You don't want it to feel, I certainly didn't want it to feel like too on the nose. So it was important that it be grounded in some way, but there was a beauty. I think, it was important that the aesthetic of the movie be that this character who's going through so much loss, like, be surrounded by beauty. That's the tragedy of it, It's like, what does it all mean if what you're feeling is such pain. And yet it is, funnily enough, I mean, it is art that actually turns the character around. And we had that scene in the L'Orangerie in Paris with the Monets that acted as this big kind of turning point for the character. And I mean, speaking of like a wonderful day at work, they shut down the Monets for us. And we spent an entire day in there by ourselves. And I mean, I think that it's a spiritual space. I think it is like the closest I've felt to like a religious space. And I've been in religious spaces. It was, anyone that has the opportunity to go, I would encourage you to go, because the design of that space, the custom work and how it fits in that space, how you feel when you're there, looking around at people who are taking in that work, it's like incredibly moving. And, you know, when we went on the Tech Scout and we walked in and we were completely by ourselves, like a lot of our crew members started crying. That's how overwhelming it is. That's how overwhelming kind of the beauty of the work is. It's very moving.
And he was losing his sight, wasn't he, when he painted it?
Yeah. So it was all kind of, you know, the impression of the
sadness. Yeah.
of the water lilies. It was,
and also Arnaud Valois, who's your co-actor in that. He's just so handsome and wonderful, but he's just gives such
yes,
a great performance. But he gives such a great performance. I wrote him a note actually the other week, just because we've followed each other for years, and I just said like, your
did he ignore
is actually,
you,
like,
or did he heart
no,
it?
He wrote back
oh, he
to
did,
me.
Okay.
We're friends through Alex at Gucci,
oh, okay.
ex Gucci. Yeah. Anyway. He's amazing as well, so big shout out to him. So we ask every guest three questions.
Which you know, Dan.
I do know.
So the first is, if you could do an imaginary art heist, which is handy because we're talking about the Orangerie in Paris. Maybe it's a museum piece, I have no idea. But if you could take an artwork home, what would it be and why?
It would be the water lilies.
Oh.
From that space. I mean, I'd be essentially like desecrating a sacred space. But in this world, I feel like that doesn't matter.
And would you put
and
them in your
like
guest
Netflix.
Toilet, like the
yeah, I'd like hang them vertically
in a bathroom with a steamy shower.
Yeah, exactly. I'd somehow have to build an entire new house to just house them.
You could just have the orangery. You could just live there. That would be your new,
oh,
your new apartment.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Your,
I'll just
your Paris
kind of
bolt hole.
Squatter's rights my way into that space and force everybody out.
What is your favorite color?
Blue.
Because?
And why blue?
Because it's the color of the sky and the water, and those are my two favorite things to look at.
Oh, nice.
And what is the best advice you've ever received in terms of your creativity or acting or writing? Or collecting art?
Oh. You really have to check your ego in order to succeed creatively, I think.
Explain that, extrapolate that a bit more.
Well, because I think our egos hold us back from exploring like truth in a way. And if we, you know, if we care too much about what people think, or if we care too much about how we're going to look, then you're standing in the way of your own sort of self-expression. So anytime I at least go to make something, it's always kind of with the idea that I'll be checking that the ego at the door, and I'll sit down to my, you know, computer and start to write, hopefully free of that. And then you save that for after, and then you realize that people have to see it and people have to like, you know, criticize it. And then the ego comes back into play, but the process should be as ego free as possible. At least from my experience.
Amazing. Oh. Well, this has been incredible.
Before we go, by the way, I love this little story about you buying an artwork in the pandemic online of a portrait of one of the characters in Schitt's Creek.
So, yeah, someone had painted, had uploaded a painting, like uploaded a painting to Instagram of
yes.
Moira Rose. And
She's
I thought it was so...
Anna Brindley.
Yeah.
Anna Brindley.
And I asked her if I could buy it. And it's now in my living room.
Oh, it's so sweet. It's a really sweet watercolour. And she literally made her life because she was a massive fan of you and the show and everything. And then one day she stopped working or something and went to her Instagram and just saw it and was like, what the fuck? I thought that was so sweet, that story. It's such a lovely one.
Yeah, I mean, she went so far as to paint it and put it out there. It's like, you know, you have to pay attention.
Yeah,
was it thousands and thousands of dollars?
She charged me $250,000 for it.
So. Yeah. That's why you changed her life.
Catherine O'Hara.
Yeah, exactly.
It's worth it. She's worth it.
Well, thank you so much, Dan.
Thank you so much.
It's been amazing. Everybody, please check out Good Grief on Netflix.
Margate has a sort of guest appearance in the film. Everyone, you know, wait for that moment because it made me very proud and confused.
I know, thanks to Emma Corrin, who told me about it. Because I needed a coastal place where artists gather. And Emma was like, I've got a house.
We love you, Dan. And congratulations on
this
epic achievement.
This has been so great. And thanks for helping to open my eyes epic. To art, boys.
I know. I was going to ask you what snacks or what music you listen to when you're writing. But now we know you listen to talk art.
There you go.
There we go.
We'll be back very soon. Thank you for listening and have a wonderful day in LA.
Thanks, Dan.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
Bye, guys.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram @TalkArt, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.